Welcome to the HPPR Radio Readers Book Club's holiday tradition, A Carol Dickens Christmas, conversations with author Thomas Fox Averill. Sit back and enjoy a modern-day exploration of themes, music, seasonal, and savory selections worthy of Dickens, past, present, and future.
Hello, I'm Thomas Fox Averill, the author of A Carol Dickens Christmas, a novel that, as you might suspect, owes a lot to Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. In fact, we all owe a lot to Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, which has always been part of my family tradition. But really, Charles Dickens invented the kind of Christmas that we all celebrate today. I should say Carol Dickens' Christmas simply is a novel about Carol Dickens, who is a woman in transition. Carol's son, Finn, has decided to graduate at semester and go off to college early. Her ex-husband, Caldwell Dunmore, sees his chance to leave Topeka, Kansas and move to a sunnier, warmer climate. The family dog, Scraps, is dying. Carol's co-worker, Lawrence Timmons, who is wheelchair-bound, decides to move closer to her. With all these transitions in the making, she hangs desperately on to traditions. Here's a bit from the novel. First there was Christmas, and usually on the second Friday in December, she and Finn would read a page or two of Dickens' A Christmas Carol over dinner. They would finish the book with God Bless Us Everyone on Christmas Eve. They took their Christmas meals from Dickens as well. They began with a dinner like the unredeemed Scrooge might eat, as though appetite were suspicious. A bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of underdone potato. Then the Cratchit meal, when only appetite could compensate for thin resources. A small goose with sage and onion dressing, applesauce and mashed potatoes, a pudding after, with a few chestnuts. They ate a Fezziwig meal, too, as though abundance and generosity could abound so simply in cold roast, cold-boiled mince pies, negus, and beer. Christmas Day feast followed the rich abundance of Christmas future. Turkey, sausages, oysters, a cornucopia of vegetables, cherry-cheeked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, and seething bowls of punch. Finally, on January 6th of the new year, the 12th day of Christmas, Carol and Finn shared a bowl of smoking bishop and an immense 12th cake before they put Christmas away. The ornaments, lights and cards, the candles, mistletoe and wreaths. The tree would lean against the trash can, abandoned and forlorn. My own relationship to Christmas and A Christmas Carol started when my wife and I and daughter Ellie made our regular drives to Dallas for Christmas with my in-laws. Turns out you can read the entire novel in the 8 hours it takes to get there. We still read it aloud, now scenes only, changing them up some every year, but usually sticking to the classic ones that delight us. Scrooge being asked for money with his "Bah, humbug" response. The Fezziwig party, when Scrooge's former master delights his apprentices with the simple pleasures of beef, beer, music, and dance. The Cratchit meal, such a lowly and humble dinner among people trying to put the best face on poverty and on Tiny Tim's disability. The party at Nephew Fred's, with its parlor games and general hilarity. The pawning of Scrooge's bed curtains and belongings in a filthy rag shop. And, of course, the final chapter that demonstrates Scrooge's redemption. These are all great scenes that anybody who has read the book will remember and delight to or be horrified by. I was particularly interested in Dickens' theme of the transformation that can happen in the spirit of the Christmas season. Actually, in researching, I realized just how much Dickens' A Christmas Carol created this Christmas that we know today. He single-handedly created a special season. As Dickens has Scrooge's nephew Fred proclaim, "I have always thought of Christmas as a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time, the only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts freely and to think of people below them as if they really were fellow passengers to the grave." The man who invented Christmas by Les Standiford was particularly helpful in my research as I wrote the book. As he writes, "Christmas in 1843 was not at all the premier occasion that it is today, when Christmas stories and their Grinches and elves and Santas abound. There were no Christmas cards, no Christmas trees at royal residences or White Houses, no Christmas turkeys, no orgy of gift-giving, no ubiquitous public display of nativity scenes or court fights regarding them. In the eyes of the relatively enlightened Anglican Church, moreover, the entire enterprise of celebrating Christmas smacked vaguely of paganism. And were there Puritans still around, acknowledging the holiday might have landed one in the stocks." Standiford goes on to describe the Saturnalia traditions, where servants and masters traded roles, where people indulged in food and drink, pointing out that Pope Julius I, during the first century, designated December 25th as the official date for the birth of Jesus. By 1644, Christmas keepers were so suspect that the English Parliament declared the day one of fasting and repentance. By the early 1700s, Standiford writes, the holiday had become a pale shadow of its former self, cloaked in piousness, sometimes celebrated in public, but rarely at home, short of domestic application almost entirely. For Dickens, according to Standiford, the holiday was a time of rest, of regeneration, of magic. He writes, much of Dickens' enthusiasm for the season transcended religiosity. He was appreciative of the benevolence associated with the example of the Christian Savior and embodied in the star atop the tree. In every cheerful image and suggestion that the season brings, Dickens said, may the bright star that rested above the poor roof be the star of all the Christian world. Encircled by the social thoughts of Christmas time, still let the wonderful figure of my childhood stand unchanged. Besides Dickens' A Christmas Carol, of course, I also, for A Carol Dickens Christmas, wove in the inspirations of his other Christmas novellas, as well as the biblical Christmas, with the birth of a baby, the wise men and the gifts, with the true gifts of being the baby and the possibility of love and forgiveness and redemption. I echo in places the best Christmas pageant ever, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, The Night Before Christmas, and every other story I could find and borrow from. Carol Dickens has a unique relationship with Christmas herself. One Christmas, in fact, she was forlorn and abandoned, much like the tree I read about in the first passage from the book. Here's what happened to her. Carol had been left before. She had her own ghost of Christmas past. When she was 9 years old, the year after her mother's death, her father had promised her the best Christmas ever. He always trimmed the tree and arranged presents under it on Christmas Eve, after she was asleep. She would awake to ribbons and bows above the windows, to sills and banisters festooned with greenery. A floor-to-ceiling tree twinkled with lights, sparkled with ornaments, cascaded with tinsel. Frank Sinatra or Bing Crosby crooned their white Christmases, their chestnuts on the open fire, their winter wonderlands. But she had awakened to silence and tentatively ventured from her room. The living room was bare. Her small heart pounded in her chest. Her father's bedroom door was closed. She wanted to leave it that way, but she couldn't. He lay on his bed, clothed, his head over the bedside, his necktie hanging like the clapper of a bell, but nothing sounded, not even his breath. She thought he was dead until a small gasp frightened her. She jumped back, and her foot kicked a bottle. Gin, it said. She'd been a good girl many times and taken his bottles to the trash. She would do it again. Then she'd wake him up. When she opened the pantry door, 3-pint bottles in the waste can matched the one in her hand. She didn't remember them from the day before. She threw the bottle at the others with enough force to break the glass. Carol made toast, slamming dishes on the counter. She clattered the milk bottle against the glass cup. She went to the stereo and switched the dial from phonograph to radio. She turned up the volume just in time for a shouting announcer to tell her it would not be a white Christmas. She could not eat her toast. She could not drink her milk. She waited until mid-afternoon before shaking her father's body and calling for an ambulance. After the sirens, Mrs. Moriarty from next door rushed over, all warmth and smells, and told the emergency people that Carol would be with her. Carol gave them the name of the closest relative she knew, a cousin of her dead mother who lived in the next town. "He'll be okay," one of the ambulance attendants said. He was, though he nearly died of alcohol poisoning. Carol was not okay for a long time. She spent that Christmas trying hard to keep from spoiling the Moriarty's dinner. She stayed the night with them. Mrs. Moriarty's final bedtime words were, "Merry Christmas, hon. You'll get this all straightened out." Straightened out meant going to live with another of her mother's cousins, 2 states away. She saw her father only on special occasions, her birthday for 3 years, 2 more Christmases, a Thanksgiving, and an Easter, when he'd shown up to take her shopping for the prettiest dress in town. And then he was dead. Suicide, some whispered. Drank himself into the grave, others muttered. "What's the difference?" asked Carol's guardian cousin. "He's dead, and we must get on with our lives." For years after, Carol disliked Christmas. Now, her rituals helped her through the season. I must say that in some ways that scene reminds me a little bit of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol and his own unhappy childhood when he makes the decision to become hard-bitten and to not like Christmas and to not like joy because of some dissatisfactions in his own life. And in some ways, A Christmas Carol follows that same pattern, the ghost of Christmas past, present, future, because the past always haunts us as we move forward in our lives in the present and anticipate the future, which is sort of equal parts joy and perhaps doom. We don't really know. So Carol has this one trauma, and then there's a Thanksgiving before a Christmas when her husband, Caldwell Dunmore, one of the Scrooges in the book, I think, divorces her. And she's talking to Finn about it in the present of the book. She says, "Do you remember the Christmas your father left?" asked Carol. Finn sat on the couch. "You broke every single ornament in the house," he said. "I stomped on the glass balls. I crushed the ceramic pieces. I ripped paper and I cut fabric. I didn't care if they were pigs, chili peppers, cats, lambs, or the baby Jesus. I only saved the ones I had picked out. And then I sat on the couch where you're sitting now and I cried." Carol leaned forward in her chair. "I didn't cry because of the destruction. I was still angry. I cried because once I destroyed everything, I saw how little of myself had ever been on those trees. 7 St. Nicholases, 6 Victorian carolers, all men." "I'm a man," said Finn. "Oh, honey, I'm not mad at you. I'm just trying to tell you how I feel. Your father left us a long time ago. I'm not angry about his leaving again, but I'm having a hard time, it's true." "We still decorated a tree that year," Finn reminded her. They had indeed. Carol had cut thin apple slices against the core, so each round slice, dried in a slow oven, revealed a star. She took needle and thread and strung the Christmas cards they'd received. She and Finn made strings of popcorn and cranberries. They glued strips of construction paper into loops that went through loops until chains of bright paper festooned the branches of the Douglas fir. Carol brought down her costume jewelry and hung earrings, bracelets, necklaces. Finn added his two neckties. His Lego men found themselves secured to thin boughs. By the end of the evening, Carol and Finn's tree bulged, glittered, and glowed in a resplendence of colors and good intentions. "Can we start all over again?" asked Carol. "What do you mean? Tomorrow, after school, do we go for a Christmas tree?" Finn, of course, is a little bit grudging about his last Christmas. So when they go to pick out a tree, it's like when he went to the pound to pick out Scraps, his childhood pet, who is now dying. Finn is a little begrudging because he's ready to move on, as teenagers get to be, and they feel bogged down in their parents' insistence on traditions and doing everything the same way. So he's trying to change that a little bit, and yet he's a very sensitive boy, too. So he understands his mother's need to complete her rituals. Here's a little bit about him when he was a little boy, and it shows you something about his tender heart. In the book, his dog, Scraps, is dying, and here's the dog. Scraps was dying. After Thanksgiving, Carol Dickens sorted through the trash to be sure her son, Finn Dickens Dunmore, hadn't stolen bones for the dog. Finn was just 6 when they had made the trip to the pound. He'd found the most forlorn, big-pawed, chewed-ear, cross-eyed mutt to claim. "Maybe not all there, that one," said the director of the humane shelter, "but good-hearted, not a whiner, not a barker either." Though reluctant, for parents are always the true owners of the animal their child picks among those caged at the shelter, Carol and Caldwell had nodded their approval. Because the dog looked so pieced together, a crazy quilt of a canine, they named him Scraps. Finn had always fed him Scraps. Dickens begins A Christmas Carol with the uncharacteristically short sentence, "Marley was dead." He wants the reader to know that when Marley appears, he is indeed a ghost. That's why I started my novel with the words, "Scraps was dying." So here's Finn picking out this Christmas tree, somewhat like he picked out the dog at the pound. Carol drove in silence until they turned into the optimist lot. "Pick out a tree, your choice," she said to Finn. She opened her door and walked past the little trailer where two men sat smoking cigarettes and watching television. One of them waved. Finn remained in the Subaru. Carol sized up blue spruce, Douglas fir, Scotch pine, all compacted from being wrapped tightly for shipment. She found several that might fill their living room. She knew the firs would smell richest, bringing the season to their noses as well as their eyes. Carol went behind a row of trees to wait out Finn's resistance. A wet snow stopped falling. The clouds moved slowly away, stars twinkling between puffs and billows. A clear night would mean real cold. After a few minutes, Carol couldn't help but pull a tree from where it leaned against the makeshift fence. Though it was half again her height, she held it at arm's length like a large dance partner, turning it so she could judge it from all sides. She nodded approvingly. One of the optimists approached her. "You found yourself the best tree on the lot," he said. "I always do," said Carol. "But your young fella found what he wants. He said you'd pay." The man pulled a pack of cigarettes from his jacket pocket and tamped one out. "Your son?" he asked. Carol nodded. "He's going to college next month." The man lit his cigarette, took a deep drag, and blew the smoke into the sky. "I'm not going to charge you anything for the tree he picked out. You can tell him you paid me back here, or I can tell him the tree's not for sale." "Is it that bad?" Carol smiled. Once I took my little girl to the pound. She picked the mangiest, skinniest, raggedy kitten, but she loved it dearly. She's off to college herself. I swear she misses that cat more than she misses me. But not more than you miss her, asked Carol. The man busied himself with his cigarette. Carol walked from behind the rows of trees toward the little trailer. Finn's spruce did not even reach his shoulders. When he spun it for her, she could see the gaps, the mismatched lengths of the branches, the total lack of symmetry, the bunch of needles huddled together near the middle. The optimist was right. He had picked the worst tree on the lot. The other man came out of the trailer and dutifully cut an inch from the bottom of the tree trunk. So it's even shorter, Carol said. I've already paid, Carol said to Finn. Let's go make a home for your tree. She reached into her purse and threw Finn the keys. He opened the back of the wagon. For once, the tree fit in easily. No moving the back seat forward, no twining the rear hatch to the bumper because the bottom of the huge tree jutted out. Finn hurried to the passenger seat and climbed in. Carol waved a thanks to the man in the lot. When she opened her door, Finn asked, Did you see what was in the tree? In the tree? Asked Carol. You don't know everything, said Finn. Finn carried the tree into the house. Carol carried the tree stand into the hallway and held the miserable little nothing of a tree in the base of the stand while Finn twisted the screws into the trunk. The trees listed slightly, but Carol didn't insist on perfection. Anything right about the tree's position in the stand would just call attention to all that was wrong with the tree. And so much was wrong. Except at just above where she held the trunk of the tree, where the branches seemed clumped together, Carol saw what Finn had seen. She pulled out the bird's nest, woven expertly from needles, straw, leaves, string, feathers, even a length of what looked like green tooth floss, all mudded together to shape a rounded nest as elegant, as perfect, as the tree was pitiful. Cool, huh? Asked Finn. I want to talk a little bit about the characters in the book and kind of what they do. Of course, we know Carol and Finn already. And Carol is a reference librarian in a small university in Topeka. I myself taught at Washburn University for 37 years, so I was sort of modeling her university after my own. And Carol is currently on a sabbatical from the university and doing research in her area. And I want to read just a little bit of a description of what research she does. Carol's large research topic was transition, particularly the slow, nearly indiscernible shifting from the Victorian period to the modern. She studied the turnings of taste, forms, and attitudes. And I wanted Carol to study transitions because she's not very good at them. And I thought it would be sort of an ironic study for her to make. For a London conference, Carol's immediate subject was the semicolon. Its fading use due to shorter sentences, and she wondered, less complicated thinking and language? She thought it signaled a turning away from the Victorian splendor of Charles Dickens and other practitioners of the capacious novel. At the same time, she'd noticed, typefaces had become sleekly modern. All of the arts followed suit, the most lamentable being architecture. Carol enjoyed counting semicolons in spite of brow-raising colleagues, baffled administrators, and her puzzled son. Finn played trumpet, and Carol tried to explain her interest to him by using his musical vocabulary. Punctuation created rhythm. Like the rests in music or the bars that separated one measure from another, commas, semicolons, and colons announced how to read. One early punctuation theorist suggested that readers pause one beat for a comma, two for a semicolon or colon, and three for a period or end stop. Punctuation conducts the music of language, Carol concluded. I've never been to a punctuation concert, he said. You've been to poetry readings. You can't detect punctuation when you hear a poem, but it's there. She was certainly finding ample punctuation in the first chapters of four Charles Dickens novels, Our Mutual Friend, Great Expectations, Oliver Twist, and Bleak House. She wasn't surprised to find more semicolons in the beginnings of chapters. Dickens, after all, would be writing exposition, description, the dense language that painted character and scene and thematic nuance. Of the 10 semicolons in the first chapter of Our Mutual Friend, 8 of them appeared in the first 750 words. Similarly, in Oliver Twist, Carroll counted 15 right away, then only 4 more by the end of the chapter. Bleak House, such a giant of a book, did not surprise Carroll with its 23 semicolons in chapter 1. Such a lot of work Dickens had to do to create that world. Great Expectations saw a more even distribution. By mid-afternoon, eyes tired and the evening's meal to attend to, Carroll shut her book. Perhaps the next day she'd delve into something modern. Maybe D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. No semicolons on the first page of that straightforward book. So punctuation and the semicolon really come together as central to the meaning of the book. People have asked me as the writer, did you really count all those semicolons? And did you really believe what Carroll believed, that the lack of semicolon does show a transition into modern? And, well, it's something I made up for Carroll to do, but yes, I did count all those semicolons. And yes, I do think language does change, and language does indicate how we live and who we are at any given time. And so those of you who are reading the book, you'll notice that it moves back and forth between sections in which Carroll is sort of the main character and sections in which Finn is sort of the main character. And the Carroll sections are full of semicolons, just as Carroll sections would be. And Finn's are very straightforward, declarative sentences, as a young man's sentences might indeed be. And so by the very end of the book, there's a little moment where there's a toast. At the end of the evening, Carroll made a toast. She stood next to Lawrence. This Christmas has been a time of great transitions. I look forward to the new as much as I have relished the old. But like Scrooge, I promise to always live in the present, as a baby does. Hear, hear, shouted Lawrence Timmons. God bless the end of this long sentence. No, said Carroll Dickens. No end punctuation. No periods. The others in the room would not understand her, but she didn't care. Allow me to toast the semicolon. She raised her glass. The go-between of clauses and meanings. The transition mark that tells us there is more to come. The signal that promises all shall be joined in meaning. To semicolons, used and still to be used, God bless them, every one.
You're listening to the HPPR Radio Readers Book Club's Holiday Tradition, A Carol Dickens Christmas, conversations with author Thomas Fox Averill, who continues.
Well, I find I've mostly been talking about Carol Dickens, and of course it is a Carol Dickens Christmas, but I want to talk a little bit about some of the other characters and give a little more sense, too, of Finn. Finn likes stars, which is good for a Christmas book, and he likes the nighttime. And I'd like to describe a little of what happens right after his father leaves the family. Finn's first stars were glow-in-the-dark, five-pointed monstrosities stuck up in the shapes of the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, Orion, and Pegasus. Back then, after lights out, his ceiling glowed. He lay in bed, peaceful with his crude creations, until he heard raised voices downstairs. Caldwell, his father, left during the Thanksgiving of Finn's 11th year. So Finn ripped down the little boy stars, painted his walls and ceiling black, and created a second universe. Whenever Carol objected, he stopped her with his incredible knowledge of the heavens. He was recreating the galaxy as it would have appeared from North America on the night of the crescent moon closest to the day of his own birth. He showed her an approximation he'd found in a book. He cut tiny points of stars and rounded planets from fluorescent tape and replaced his light bulbs with black light. He painted his window shades black, creating an ever-present night. "It's so dark," Carol complained. "I have enough light to do everything," Finn said, and he had for the past 7 years. Finn, like Charles Dickens himself, is a walker, and he walks especially at night, and the book begins with one of his adventures. And this is a description, too, of Topeka, Kansas, where the book is set. And one of the joys of sort of recreating Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol was to do it in a place like Topeka, Kansas, where people wouldn't expect sort of the drama and comfort even of knowing London and the fog and all the familiar things. So here's Finn on the night of December 12th. He walked north over the Kansas Avenue Bridge above the moonlit stream of the Kansas River, then east over the Sardou Bridge into Oakland. Crossing a bridge, the river flowing below, himself so high, really getting somewhere, Finn left one riverbank behind to find himself on another. Just after 11 o'clock, walking briskly down Division Street, heading west, he looked for the steeple of Our Lady of Guadalupe Church. All around the church, in well-kept one-story homes, lived much of Topeka's Mexican population. Some were new arrivals, but most were the descendants of Mexicans lured to the city in the early 20th century by jobs on the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad. Many of them the grandparents and great-grandparents of his friends at school strung the best Christmas lights in town. Roof lines, gutters, fences, even the borders of yards themselves would be lit. Statues, life-sized crèches, plastic reindeer, and pink-faced Santas adorned the sidewalks, driveways, carports. Lights spelled out Merry Christmas, Feliz Navidad, Paz, Christ the King. In Oakland, colors were bright, varied, chaotic, almost ill-mannered. Christmas here seemed to be a party, a fiesta of faith. Finn loved the contrast to his own gloomy Victorian home. He walked down Lake Street toward Our Lady of Guadalupe. A man shouted from a rooftop, "On! Ahora mismo! Turn them on!" Someone obeyed, and a rainbow of lights cascaded across the housetop. "Looks good, Papa," said a female voice. "Hold the ladder, puta," said the man. "Get down by yourself." "The ladder is steep, hija," the father said. "And you are drunk," said the daughter. The porch light snapped on, and an old woman in a shawl came out. The daughter, her face now lit by the yellow porch light, was Gabriela, Finn's friend from the trumpet section in the Topeka High School band. Everyone said she hadn't come to school that year because she was pregnant. Finn had wondered about her. They'd once gone to a concert together when they were freshmen. Now her belly was so swollen she couldn't button her coat except at the top. The old woman went to the ladder. "Está fría la noche," she said, looking up. Then Gabriela climbed the porch stairs. She turned. She seemed to wave. Had she seen him? He ducked behind a tree. She went into the house. Her father clanked down the rungs of the aluminum ladder, held steady by what must be Gabriela's grandmother. Still, the father missed the last rung and fell to the ground, cursing. The old woman walked into the house. The man picked himself up and stomped up the porch stairs. On the third stair, his foot crumbled through rotting wood. "Mierda," he said. He lifted his foot from the hole he'd made in the step. He ripped up the loose board and heaved it onto the roof before he stormed into the house. Finn hurried away. Gabriela had been good on the trumpet. She'd started playing with the hope of joining her aunt's mariachi band. But her father would hardly let her out of the house except for school functions or church. She joined the school band so she could go to football games and band trips at least. The previous year, she'd missed rehearsals in April and didn't show up for the year-end concert in May. Finn walked past Our Lady of Guadalupe, past more houses with more lights. He turned west again, went up the Branner Street Bridge, known to many as the Fiesta Bridge, above the railroad tracks, and then down 4th Street, across the many sets of tracks, past the Santa Fe Depot, under the highway, through the edge of downtown, and back to his central Topeka neighborhood. Gabriela had been so huge. She'd probably have her baby any day. Finn was fascinated by the image of her unbuttoned coat, mussed-up hair, the little wave of her hand. The more he thought about her, the more he was certain she had seen him. I must say it's good for every Christmas book to have someone who's pregnant and needing a place to give birth. And, of course, Finn is also a trumpet player, as mentioned there. And the college where he's going to go at semester has given him a music scholarship. And during the course of the book, he joins in to play with the mariachi band of Gabriela's Aunt Teresa. And here's a little scene of mariachi. Teresa started away, then came back. Maybe you would like to listen. See if you like the music. We rehearse today at 4:30, then again on Thursday. Gabriela knows where. I'll tell her father she needs to come again. She'll tell you how to find us. Bring your horn. Finn shrugged, but Gabriela nodded, yes. After Tia Teresa left, Finn leaned close to Gabriela. Will your father let you come to the rehearsal? Teresa is my mother's sister, said Gabriela. He doesn't dare cross her. So that Tuesday, Finn hurried from school to North Topeka. He listened to the band for half an hour, then took out his trumpet. We have only a few pieces of music for you to read, said Teresa. The traditional music. We older ones have it in here and here. And she put her hand to her head and then over her heart. When there is no music, find what is in your heart. Improvise. Finn did his best and promised to return. Now Finn was keeping his promise, trudging through Topeka on a cold Thursday, the middle three fingers of his right hand lifting off the handle of his trumpet case in rhythm to music that had already begun to live in his head. He liked the wailing, the staccato syncopations, the close harmonies of the sometimes boisterous, sometimes plaintive music from Mexico. Of course, he'd known about mariachi all his life, starting with his family's annual pilgrimage to the Mexican fiesta held each July in what always seemed the hottest days imaginable. He noticed the costumes first, the wide-brimmed hats, the spangled shirts and pants, the colorful swaths of cloth the same red and green as the Mexican flag. Then he noticed the instrumentation, violins, guitars, from small to the big guitarron, and trumpets. Then he heard the music. He imagined playing it just as Folklorica played each year, as did other mariachi bands from Texas and Mexico during the week-long fiesta that raised funds for the Guadalupe school. Finn knocked on the storefront door, and boot steps clattered down the stairs with an un momento. A 14-year-old trumpeter opened the door and smiled a greeting. Our gringo, said the boy, smiling. El señor gringo, joven, said Finn. Up the stairs, and in what had once been a ballroom, the band members were tuning their instruments, strumming and sawing, banging and adjusting. Gabriela sat along the wall. With her was the old woman Finn had seen the first time he walked past Gabriela's house. The woman sat with her arms folded over her chest. Finn went straight to her and held out his hand, but the woman did not take it. So you are the young man, she asked. Gabriela elbowed her. Abuela, she whispered harshly. Un amigo solo, no más. What are you doing here? The old woman asked Finn. She adjusted a shawl over her long white hair. I came to play my trumpet. He lifted the trumpet case. And my Gabriela must be here for you to play. Finn hoisted his trumpet case onto a chair and unlatched it. His lips would serve him better on the horn than they would trying to form words. Let the old woman think what she wanted to think. Adults were always laying their ideas, their hang-ups, their craziness on their children and grandchildren. Finn liked Gabriela. He wanted to help her. Finn liked music. Finn didn't want to be at home or at school. Everything should just be simple, he wanted to tell Gabriela's abuela. He supposed they all thought he had something to do with Gabriela's pregnancy. He blew into his horn, climbed up and down his range, puckered his lips, smiled at the old woman. Then he didn't think about anything but the music, its sonorous lamenting, its barking joy, its whooping pleasure in the rises and falls, its intricate rhythms. When he had no music to read, when none of them looked at notes, he listened to the other trumpeter. The horns were often punctuation, as his mother might say, to the music, exclamation points, quick question marks with even quicker answers, underlinings, stuttering commas, and transitional dashes and semicolons. He wasn't the music, but he helped the music be what it was. In band, he was used to melody, to playing the whole sentence. He enjoyed being the punctuation. You know, working with A Christmas Carol as a model, and with Charles Dickens in general, just gave me such freedom and license to create characters that are eccentric. And one of those, and one of my very favorites in the book, is a man named Mr. Harry Marble, a chimney sweep who rents space in Carol's large carriage house behind her Victorian home in central Topeka. And he's kind of the book's St. Nicholas, you know, in terms of chimneys, in terms of knowing who's naughty and who's nice. And I want to read a passage that describes how Finn and Carol met Mr. Marble. They had moved into the old Victorian house when he was 6 years old. He had been fascinated by fireplaces, and his mom and dad had given him the one upstairs room that had one. He'd never been allowed to light a fire, but he could feel the air currents lift and sigh and blow when the wind shifted or the temperature changed. Finn's fireplace was a stethoscope to the outdoors. One day, in the spring of his fifth grade year, he heard a rustling above the damper, a scratching sound like his mom filing her nails. A week later, he awoke to tiny mewling noises. The squeals increased in volume over the next 2 weeks, and Finn still didn't tell his parents until from the smell he knew skunks were nesting in his fireplace. His mom and dad called a pest removal company who recommended a chimney sweep known to solve problems with squirrels, pigeons, possums, and other intruders. Mr. Marble was an unlikely savior. He sat on the porch swing, his legs not quite touching the porch floor, as Finn returned from school one day. "Skunks, is it?" asked the old man. He stuck out his hand. "Harry Marble," he said, "ready for action." Mr. Marble wore a dilapidated felt hat with a bright red feather springing from the band. His teeth were crooked when he smiled, and his wrinkled face was paradoxically smooth, worn and soft at the same time like an old paving brick. Finn sat next to him on the swing. "You going to kill him?" he asked. "You want me to?" asked Mr. Marble. "What did my parents say?" Finn asked. "What do you say?" The old man folded his arms against his chest. "Well, they don't even smell that much," Finn said. "But they make a lot of noise, am I right? And they're night creatures, so they're keeping you up past your bedtime. And the older they get, the worse it'll be, I can tell you that." "So are you going to kill them?" asked Finn. "Yeah, let's see," said Mr. Marble. "Up past bedtime, noisy, worse the older they get, a little smelly. Describes teenagers, too, doesn't it? But you can't kill teenagers, can you?" Mr. Marble stood up and went to the porch railing. He leaned over and his head followed the chimney bricks up the side of the house. "This the one?" he asked. Finn nodded. "No cap on it. I could see that when I pulled up. But you can't cap it when something's living in there. Did you hear her lining her nest?" "I heard some scratching," Finn said. "Tell me all about it," said Mr. Marble. "Then we'll go and take a look." And so Finn lets him into the house, and then Carol comes home, and Mr. Marble excuses himself to wash his hands as he's been inspecting the rusted chimney damper. And Carol says, "You shouldn't have let him in. His mom always worried so much. Well, he didn't kill me or steal anything." "Ms. Dickens, I do not come to steal, but to remove." Mr. Marble took a CD from the inside of his jacket. "Here's what you need. When they're gone, call me and I'll cap your chimney. The damper may be ruined, but if you don't use this fireplace, you'll be fine." And he handed the CD to Carol. "What do I do with this?" she asked. "Well, you play it," Mr. Marble grinned. "All day when they're trying to sleep, they won't last long." Then he was gone, and so Finn heard Metallica for the first time. "Kill 'Em All" played from the time Mr. Marble left until Finn went to bed. His mom shuddered at the sound, like so many nails on a chalkboard. Finn determined to like the music. The next day, a Saturday, Finn kept the music playing. When Metal Militia was over, Finn started to hit the lights all over again, and by the end of the weekend, the skunks were gone. I'm almost out of here myself, Carol told Mr. Marble when the old chimney sweep capped the chimney top with a little tin roof over strong mesh. Mr. Marble asked Finn if he liked Metallica. Finn grinned. Keep it, said Mr. Marble. No, said Carol. And Mr. Marble waved her away. Marble then talks to Carol about renting some space in her carriage house, and Carol and Finn watch Mr. Marble drive away. You can keep the CD, but you don't have to listen to it all the time, said Carol. You could buy me some headphones, said Finn. No, said Carol. Or you could buy yourself some earplugs. I want to hear what you're listening to. She meant she wanted to control what he listened to. And then there's another character that I mentioned earlier, Lawrence Timmons, who's kind of my Tiny Tim character. That's why I named him Timmons. He's in a wheelchair, and he's the suitor who's sort of unsettling Carol Dickens at this time. And I introduce him like this. Years before, when Caldwell left her, Lawrence had taken Carol's side, taken her on dates, almost taken her heart. And then his terrible accident and the battle for life came first, and then the adjustment to the wheelchair, and then, as Lawrence said, the battle to want to live. Lawrence tired easily. Within 6 months, he was reduced to a few loyal friends. Most loyal, Carol Dickens, stood by him as his house filled up with magazines, coffee cups, and cats. His isolation was exacerbated by his inability, or Carol called it unwillingness, to venture past his door. Weekdays, Carol helped Lawrence with his daily needs. Some things from upstairs, some things from the kitchen, some tissues and salve, food and water for the cats. He never asked much of her. He'd been a good boss and friend. How could she not feel sorry for him? But duty and pity wearing thin, she had to quit her daily visits. Carol walked into his house, and it was filled with roses, an incredible array of red and pink and yellow and white, in vases on the coffee table, the dining table, the bookshelves. Some, still swathed in green tissue, lay on the couch, the chairs, the floors. Took me 2 florists, Lawrence said. The second one ran out of vases. All I could do to keep them from telling what I was up to. And what are you up to? Carol began collecting the unvased flowers. You can't ask, you have to say, said Lawrence. Carol went to the kitchen. And then you'll tell me what this is all about, she called out. You might count them. Lawrence wheeled through the dining room to watch her. He gave her his contradictory smile, his mouth drawn down by pain and persistence, his eyes clear blue and sparkling, his forehead wrinkled with happiness. They're for you, he said, one for each day you've come over to help. I haven't thanked you enough. Lawrence held out his arms, and she came to him. As a short person, she hardly bent to give the seated man a quick hug. You were ready to break my heart, he said. Carol walked into the living room. The blinds were hardly open, the room sepia, a cat stretched. Why didn't you want to talk it out? Lawrence wheeled into the room. Your needs and mine, my disability against your ability, your disability against my ability. You think our relationship is one-sided. Carol said nothing. The roses are us, Lawrence said. We together. They're not about single days. They're about accumulation. I wanted you to see how affection has grown in my heart. While I've grown thorns in my heart, Carol asked. Wasn't that his implication, that she was ready to abandon him, to ignore their friendship, because she feared deepening their relationship? Lawrence wheeled to her. You think I'm the thorn in your side. He took her hand. You're the petal of the rose, Carol. Carol pulled away from him. I need to concentrate, she said. Finn will be gone soon. He's distant. I want to focus on him, give him something before he leaves next month. Why not give him happiness, asked Lawrence, though I guess you'd have to start being happy first. Carol also has this ex-husband, whom I've mentioned, Caldwell Dunmore, who is seen by Carol as villainous, of course, and I mentioned earlier that he's ready to sort of decamp at the same time as his son. So I'd like to read a letter that he sends to her right at the beginning of the novel. And give you a sense of him. Dear Carol, as you know, I have always done my best to make improvements to this god-awful town. When the downtown center became my development priority, I believed in everything I was doing. Unfortunately, Topeka has too many citizens of small belief. In short, this city is never going to make the changes I envisioned, at least not in my lifetime. I am selling off my many properties, the rental houses, the downtown buildings, even the little piece of land off Auburn Road we bought together in hopes of building that little cabin back when such things might have been possible for us. I don't know your financial position, but I thought it might be courteous of me to offer you first grabs on the Auburn land and on my downtown building with the loft. The Auburn land will sell for over $2,000 an acre, and I'd like to keep all 40 acres together if possible. My guess is that you might not be in a position to acquire such a large parcel of undeveloped land. But as Finn will be leaving for college next month, and aren't you proud of his initiative, I thought you might actually want to downsize a bit and leave your old Victorian for something smaller and more manageable. I can make you a very good offer on my loft, for old time's sake. As for me, now that Finn is graduating and leaving town, I feel I can go too. I've had an offer from some business associates in Tucson. Arizona is sympathetic to development. It's a place, my associates assure me, without the downtrodden mental attitude of so many Midwestern cities where all excitement, even that of development, is suspect. I am half divested already and want to start the new year in a new place with a new attitude. You know I'll help with Finn's move to college and all that entails. Please let me know in the enclosed envelope what your thoughts are about the loft and the land. I know this may be a difficult time for you. Thanksgiving and Christmas always have been. But I would appreciate your response before the new year. Sincerely, Caldwell. To which I hope readers say, bah, humbug. Carol can only think of Caldwell in sort of the worst way. And I had fun with this passage sort of imitating the way Charles Dickens would write about Scrooge. God, if Dickens had written about Caldwell Dunmore, Carol's mood curdled. Dickens would have renamed him, of course, something like Cadwood Doolittle. Carol could imagine the prose. He was a selfish man, a mean, tight-hearted, clutch-fisted man, thin as gruel, just short enough to worry about his size, just vain enough to trim his mustache to as thin a pencil as he was, just pompous enough to include a self-addressed stamped envelope to force replies to his formal proposals, first of separation, then divorce, and now divestment. What had she seen in the man? His confidence had been mere bravado. His clear sense of the future had been for his future alone. What he called my life plan had never included Carol and Finn. Humbug, Dickens would never write about such a man. At least Scrooge could be set on the path to redemption. Gabriella, of course, is another major character in the book, and she needs Finn's help, but Finn also needs Gabriella. And here's a reason why Finn looks to her. For the past 4 days, Finn had eaten lunch at Rosaria's with Gabriella. Finn blessed administrators too busy with the problem kids to worry about the couple hours Finn stole from the middle of the day. Most of all, Finn blessed Gabriella. She understood him when he talked about his needy mother, his long absent father, his few teachers who couldn't see he was already out of there, his plans for himself once he was away at college, how he wanted to understand music like he'd never had time to, see it differently from anyone else in the world. She understood his love for scraps, his ability to care when most kids were too cool to give a damn. Gabriella laughed at him when he stuttered in Spanish, but she could tell she liked him to try. She liked him to worry about her. She asked each day if he had talked to his father. Finn wanted to wait for the end of the semester concerts, where he'd see his father anyway, but Gabriella was urgent. A new owner might kick them out or raise the rent. They might even have to go back to Mexico, her father had said, now that she had shamed the family. In an ironic twist, it turns out that Caldwell actually owns the house that Gabriella is living in. And so there's this connection. And I tried for that all through the novel, that like in a Dickens novel, everything is woven together in one community, even though you don't know it at first. "Maybe the house won't sell for a while," Gabriella said, "and in less than 2 weeks it won't matter." "Why?" asked Finn. "I'll be 18, Gabriella said. "My father will have no control over me. I will move out of the house." "Until then?" Finn asked. "I pray he doesn't do something crazy." "Until then, the little one must wait." She patted her womb. "I don't understand," said Finn. "Before I'm 18, my father can decide what happens to my baby. He will force me to give it to another family. After my birthday, I can decide." "What will you decide?" asked Finn. "I don't have to know until December 29th, said Gabriella. "How can I help you?" asked Finn. "Already you are helping me," said Gabriella. So Gabriella has Finn planning for her and helping her. Gabriella could have her baby any day, Finn realized. He crawled back into bed. Gabriella would be in her bed, too, in the small room at the back of her little house. Outside her windows, the Christmas lights her father had strung across the roof and along the guttering would glow like a nightlight, enough for her to see the cross on her wall. Jesus, crucified, nailed, tortured, triumphant. He would redeem everyone through his suffering, though he could not stop anyone's suffering. Gabriella lay swollen with child, huge and tortured by the guilt her father flogged her with, and her father in the next room lay tortured by what he considered his family shame, that a daughter would be pregnant with a boy to marry, and her abuela lay in the converted closet just big enough for a cot, windowless and darker than the thousand moonless Mexican nights, wondering what might become of her hijo, her nieta, her casa, with its for sale sign stuck in the yard, announcing to everyone that soon they would have to move, as they had so many times before. How many more times would they have to move? When would they find a real home?
You're listening to the HPPR Radio Readers Book Club Holiday Tradition, A Carol Dickens Christmas, conversations with author Thomas Fox Averill. Now that we're familiar with the characters in this modern-day telling, we'll celebrate Carol Dickens Christmas with a reader's feast of food, music, and gifts.
Aguas siguen creciendo, forman inundación. Y te hundes si no empiezas nadando. Te ahogas ahí mismo, una piedra.